I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Patrick Ryan's novel Buckeye was released in September, and it's another one of those books that people can't stop talking about. It's been long listed for the 2026 Joyce Carol Oates Award and has popped up on numerous book club and bestseller lists. Buckeye is a multi-generational story that follows an impulsive and fateful decision made on VE Day in 1945. I recently spoke with Patrick Ryan about the story, its characters, his writing process, and more. Here's our conversation. So your novel was released in September, but long before that, many of my bookseller friends told me I should read it. Yet they gave no indication of what the book was about. I kind of loved experiencing it with no expectation or preconceived notions. So it feels a little hypocritical for me to ask this, but could you give our listeners a description of Buckeye? Is there anything we should know going in?
Yeah, thank you. It's a story that begins with two people meeting in a small town in Ohio right at the moment of the Allied victory in Europe near the end of World War II. And it spans 60 years in the lives of these two families and focuses on how one bad decision and its ripple effects and the lies and secrets that unfold from it shape them and shape the generation to come.
Let's give a little bit of background here. So could we get a short overview of, you know, the main four key players here? Who are Cal, Becky, Felix, and Margaret?
Cal is someone who grew up in this small town, and the woman that he marries, Becky, is also someone who grew up in this small town of Bonamy, Ohio, which is a fictitious town. I deliberately didn't want to have to adhere to an actual place, although I wanted to set it in a very real geographic context. And with the other couple, Margaret is someone who brings to the table of their marriage a past that she wants to keep hidden for various reasons. And her husband, Felix, has an entire side of his life that he is grappling with that he also doesn't want to show her. So there's a lot of secrets and lies told to the people that you love the most and to yourself over time that fuel the novel. And then later there are, and that when the novel gets into the next generation, there are a couple of other characters, children, become key players in the story.
So now that we have been introduced to some of the characters, I do want to ask a question about this fictional town, Bonamy, Ohio. Is it based on a specific town, or is it purely from your imagination?
Well, my father's half of the family is from Ohio. I grew up in Florida. When I was growing up, vacations for us meant either driving to the grandparents in Georgia or driving to the grandparents in Ohio. Going to Ohio from Florida to me was fascinating always as a little kid, because not only did it have winter, snow, and all that stuff, but it had basements and attics and these things that we just didn't get in Florida, especially the basement part. So I was drawn to it. And then I lived there for a couple of years when I went to graduate school in the late 80s. And to me, it was just a place that interested me for its landlockedness, if that's a word, because having grown up on the coast of Florida, I was always very aware when I was in Ohio that I wasn't near much water till you get up to the north edge and get to one of the Great Lakes, which is also an area that I found fascinating. But I thought for a little bit that I would base this on my father's hometown, since that was a small little town I was interested in. There were two things. One, I realized that town was too small for my needs. It still is. It's Fredericktown, Ohio. That's a really tiny place. I also sort of wanted to move more into the Northwest, an area that I was a little more familiar with, because I knew that as a grown-up. So the town is, I picture this as being right close to Findlay. I think that's sort of clear in the book. Findlay is the nearest, biggest place to Bonamy. And I pictured it maybe around the size of Bowling Green would have been, say, in the 40s, because I looked up the population of that town. When I wrote my first book, it was a collection of interlinked short stories, and it was based on my hometown. And so even though that covered several decades, that research was easy, interesting. I did it with complete assurance, you know, But as soon as I thought about writing about a tiny town in Ohio that was real, that was going in a story that was going to cover all those decades, I thought, man, I'm going to have to adhere to which direction the traffic flowed on that street and what year they got their first bank drive-through, and all these things potentially people could pop up and say, wrong, wrong. So I would liked working with a little blank canvas of my own set within the geography.
So going back to what you said earlier, the book opens on, one fateful day, VE Day, May 8th, 1945. It's real interesting place to begin the story because from here we back up and we learn more, about the upbringings of each of the principal characters, but then we also learn what happens beyond VE Day and well into the future. So why this moment in time? And is this where the book started for you? Did you always know you were going to start it on this day?
Well, all right, full confession, there was a spark from my own family that started the little flame for this book. And it was just a situation I learned about. And that was that my Ohio grandmother, who lived in that tiny town, who was a pious, judgmental, difficult person, long after she was gone, I learned that she had maintained this affair with a married man down the street for decades. And there's nothing highly original, certainly, about that situation. But it interested me because I thought, man, number one, that does not fit with any picture I have of her in my memory. It's hard for me to place that circumstance with the person that I thought I knew, who lived until I was in my late 20s, I guess. So I didn't know her as a grown-up, too. And the other thing is that I thought about how many lies would that entail that you would be telling to the people you loved the most and the people who trusted you the most and to yourself. And they would have to start feeling like truths after a while. Starting with that, I thought, yeah, I like the idea of this. I was looking for some sort of story that would touch on things that I'm interested in, such as grief and how do you measure a person's worth. I don't lead with theme by any means. I wouldn't be able to write if I did. But I do realize as I sort of look sideways at what I'm doing over the years that these are things that keep emerging. And so I was just stuck on that thought of a young married woman having come from nothing, which was my happened to be my grandmother's circumstances. She was not an orphan or anything, but she grew up in poverty. And then stepping into adulthood and creating that kind of world for herself. And I didn't want to write about a prolonged affair. I didn't want to write about two people pining for each other while they were married to other people. Not because that's not an interesting story, but because it's been done really well by a lot of people. And so I thought, no, I'm interested in a fling. Just a fling, a mistake, you know? And so I wanted to keep the locale roughly, which would be this Ohio town, and I wanted to keep the time period because the more I started thinking about my characters and not these people from real life, the more I realized I'm interested in who these two people are married to. Do they have any kids? Will they have any kids? Who are their parents? What were their childhoods like? I immediately just I lead with character. That's how I do it, and I got into them, and then I thought, no, this is a story that is going to move into the next generation. So, that being the case, I just did some math and thought, working backward, like what's the most recent date I want this story to touch on? And I thought, well, it's probably going to be around 1980, and I don't even want to be there for very long, but that's where I want to get to. And that means by necessity that those two people are going to meet in the 40s. And I was very drawn to this idea of them meeting, not at the tail end of the war, but sort of when things seem to be winding down and having one of these characters not be able to serve. And that is something I should have said earlier, where what Cal brings to his marriage with Becky, one of the things he brings to his marriage is this ridiculous notion that he's defined by a disability, a physical disability that he has. And that's just his leg. You learn this in the first sentence of the book. He was born with one leg 2 inches shorter than the other, and he can't serve in the military. And so he carries that into adulthood as this shameful thing that means he doesn't measure up. And that becomes something that Becky has to contend with over the years.
Well, you know, Cal not being able to serve, that's just one aspect of this. But because of the timeline of your book and the extensive timeline, it allowed you to explore many wars and conflicts that the United States was a part of. What did you want to explore about war?
You know, that was something, obviously, I just said that I was interested in starting it at this point where that was going on in the world. I didn't anticipate at first that there's always a war. There's always war going on somewhere. And in that period, you had, I mean, just to point out the obvious, the people who were the children of the men who served in World War I also ended up being the parents of the kids who went off to Vietnam, if they went off to Vietnam, which kind of pivoted them in this interesting spot. And then you've got the Korean War in between World War II and Vietnam, of course. And I thought, wow, to sort of keep everybody in line, there's always this notion of there's this danger out there. It will come for you if you don't step up. It will come for you. And that went very quickly from worry about a German invasion into the United States to worrying about the Cold War, communism. They're here, they're coming after us. And I thought, well, I like the idea of thinking about a small community that is having these wars go on around the world, never where they are, but they're still living with the fear, they're living with the news. And fairly early in, I knew that, well, now I'm avoiding another spoiler, but I knew that one of the later wars was going to have a personal impact on some of these people. But I didn't quite see how that all was going to come together because I didn't want to have it all figured out. Otherwise, I wanted to write it. I've learned that from experience where to take an idea for a novel, it's kind of like, if I can use the metaphor of a big canvas that I would turn into a mural eventually if I were a painter, which I am definitely not. To figure it all out too early with notes and whatnot is to create a paint by numbers template. And there's just no fun in filling that. That's just filling in blanks. And so I wanted to leave a lot of room for exploration. But there were ways where I didn't see that this thread of war and of watching what people, what men are capable of left to their own devices and how capable they are of pulling in other men, usually younger and, not of means, into these predicaments. And I grew up with a grandfather and his twin brother, my great uncle, who had both been captains on aircraft carriers in World War II in the South Pacific. And they were that silent generation and very politely had no interest in talking about it in the gentlest way. They just never wanted to speak of it, even though I knew they weren't ashamed or that they weren't. It wasn't that they didn't want to be reminded of it because in their homes they had the portraits of them in uniform and they had their accommodations and things, but they just didn't want to discuss anything. And once I started doing a little bit of research into the veterans of World War I and what it was like when they came back, I thought, I want that kind of character too, because if that's not quite the silent generation, if I can make a character who is very vocal about what's going on in the world, to kind of play against this generation that wasn't going to want to talk about what they were going through. But it ended up being a background of war just all the way through.
I was impressed with the way you were able to weave in all of the history. And while the town and the characters were fictional, and you made a point of making the town fictional so people wouldn't be able to take you to task if you got something wrong, the history was precise. And so, I mean, what kind of research did you have to do to make sure your characters' actions were accurate within our history?
I'm interested in history the way I think anybody should be. I wouldn't consider myself a history buff. I'm not a researcher. I always put the word research in air quotes when I talk about what I did for this book. It was sort of historical by necessity because I did start it in 1945 and then it's going to move forward. And I knew I wanted it to reach back into the previous generation a bit. I did it all on an as-needed basis. And it involved a lot of, obviously, a lot of reading, documentary watching. The internet really facilitated a lot of this. The internet also seduced me into a lot of rabbit holes of research for things that I couldn't use. From what I hear, that's always the nature of research, is looking up 50 things so that you can use one thing, or looking up 10 or 12 things just so that you can be comfortable acknowledging that it happened, you know, in your narrative voice, just to have some sort of confidence about that. And I wasn't sure how much of it I was getting right. I think I did the normal kind of thing that one does in trying to put history into fiction, in that I overwrote, and then I depended on a couple of outside voices to say, now you need to scale back. And it was my editor who said, who I worked with really closely for 2 years on the book, who was able to come forward and say things like, this is a great scene, I got chills when I read it, but I don't know if it has any place in the book. I have a good friend who's a very trusted reader, who was reading early drafts before my editor ever got hold of it. And she would say, this spot here feels like an information dump. She could just be blunt like that, you know? Like, I feel like you are handing me your research. And a lot of times it wasn't because I was trying to impress, but it was because I hadn't known that stuff that maybe other people already knew. And I was just so seduced by it. And then I would write these ways of presenting it and weaving it into the narrative, only to find out that it was common knowledge, that most everybody had heard that, you know, heard about that. It was a whole new way of writing for me, I have to say, an entirely new way of writing.
You know, you have this omniscient narrator, but then you also added some avenues where we got a different perspective, like letters, especially Everett's letters to American presidents. Was this a useful tool?
Yeah, it was so fun. That character, just to give a tiny bit of context, he is the World War I veteran in the book. And he lived through the Depression. So I was trying to sort of pull into him all of the interesting things that I have heard about people of that generation. So he's a hoarder because he, what we would now call a hoarder, because he survived the Depression and knew such poverty. And he actually enlisted because it was steady work for him if he enlisted and went to war. And then I knew about the bonus marchers, the vets who came back and were marching for money that was owed to them after World War I. But I didn't really realize that the word bonus isn't quite accurate, because they weren't marching and fighting for their bonus. They were fighting for their pay. They just weren't paid. They came back and the government said, we can't afford to pay you. My gosh, look at the state of things over here. And they didn't get paid. And so they marched on Washington and the military was called out against them. And it was quite a shocking chapter in history. And so I thought, this is going to fuel this character of Everett. And he is going to write to every president. And there, of course, were many more letters in earlier drafts. I think now there might only be three in the book. One of them has a letter, of actual letter missing from his typewriter.
Mm-hmm. T.
And that was a device. thank you. And that was a device I took a little further. And then, you know, my editor said, well, less is probably more. It's starting to read like Stephen King's Misery, you know, and I thought, oh yeah, that's where I got that idea. So I pulled all that back. But it was a really fun perspective, because that is definitely not the silent generation, at least Everett's version of that.
You know, another way we were granted access to some of these characters was through Becky Jenkins and her special gift. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I will say I did not anticipate that I was going to put into this novel seance scenes, and there aren't a lot of them. Just don't want to scare anyone away. It is not my happy place as a writer to write about spiritualists, seances, that kind of thing. But I wanted her to have an ability that she truly believed in. That was where I started, is I wanted to give her something that she believed in, didn't quite understand, that had to do with talking to the dead, because it plays into what I wanted to explore with grief. And my very first thought was that I would give her this firm conviction on her part that she could hear from the dead now and then, and that the people in her immediate life were going to be looking at her kind of sideways about that. And it would be a source of contention in her marriage, but there would be other people who would take her seriously. But after a few minutes of fooling around, literally just like the same day that I came up with that, I thought, well, I'm not going to set her up to be an object of ridicule over the course of the book. She's one of the four main characters. So how do I have it and not have that be the case? I know that her loved ones are going to look at her sideways, but I don't want the reader looking at her sideways. So I thought, well, what if she can really do it, actually do it? And what if I make that clear eventually, not right away? And by the time the reader would glean that that's what the book is telling them, that, oh no, this ability is actually real, that by then they would hopefully be pulled in love with Becky, or just care about the characters in the way that was happening to me. And so that's what I did. And I thought, well, one of the interesting things about having her have that ability in this novel is that she doesn't understand it and doesn't need to. And she doesn't ever monetize her ability. She doesn't, she just uses it to try to help people if they find it helpful. And I thought, well, if she doesn't understand it and doesn't need to, then I don't understand it and I'm not going to need to. And I have a feeling the narrator understands everything, but I am not the narrator. I don't, and that might sound a little goofy, but I really did think if anybody understands what's going on with her, it's the narrator, it's this omniscient entity. But one of the things I decided as soon as I'd settled on all of that was that I wasn't going to, trying to stay away from any sort of woo-woo-ness. I never crossed the line to the other side in terms of the narrative perspective. There are a couple of appearances of ghosts, you would say, what we might call ghosts in the novel. Another thing I didn't see really coming until I got there. But I didn't want to give anything from the other side. And I wanted to avoid truly explaining to the reader what was going on, even from the narrator. So anything that is in the book, I think that is an attempt to explain it is just Becky's trying to verbalize it to someone else, which isn't the same as the narrator letting the reader in on this secret. So my hope is that that would keep the mystery at bay enough to keep it a mystery and not get bogged down in the logistics, because I feel like that's a real bad trap you can get into if you throw in a magical element like that, and then you get very specific into how it works. You get further away from the reason you put it into your story to begin with, and you get into some problematic spots.
Seems that you were able to explore the humanity, the good and the bad of many of your characters. And sometimes I was angry, sometimes I felt connected. Was there a particular character that was more challenging for you to grasp?
Yes. And I don't think the answer will surprise you. The character of Margaret was the most challenging character I've ever written about. Not just because she does some things that, say, I would never do. And it's that thing that we bring to the table as readers of fiction when we read, where you don't have to like all the characters. But what seems to me is important is you have to understand why they're doing what they're doing. You have to understand their reasoning to care about the greater situation. So I thought, well, there's a real challenge. I'm going to have her not evolve in ways that most healthy people would evolve emotionally. And I'm going to try to make it so that the reader is right there with her. Even if they're not rooting for her, they understand where she's coming from. And they can be horrified, but they get it. And this to me is the secret to writing. I would not call Margaret a villain. I don't really think there are any villains in the book. But it is a secret, I think, to writing villains is that they don't think of themselves as villains. Villains think of themselves as people who are doing reasonable, necessary things each and every time they do something. And that's what makes them not two-dimensional, and that's what makes them interesting. So it was that component. And it was also just this idea that I'm fascinated by people who seem to be unable to achieve any kind of stability in their minds or happiness, just seem to be kind of addicted to a state of agitation or just dissatisfaction. And I find it, you know, I find it tragic. If you care about somebody like that, you ache for them to grow out of that and you want to help them out. But sometimes you can't help someone else do that sometimes. And I wanted a problematic character who is like that. And I got one. I got one. But I don't know if I completely have figured her out even now. And I knew all of my insecurities about that character were confirmed once I started working with my editor, because I worked on the book for 6 years myself before I would even let my agent send it out, because I wanted to take it, you know, it's like a best foot forward kind of thing. I wanted to take it as far as I could take it before I would ask someone else to help me. And then, because at that point I would definitely need their assistance and want to hear their thoughts. And one of the big things my editor brought to the table was, I don't think you've quite figured out Margaret yet, which all had to do with the second half of the book, not the setup and the creation, which I had pored over and pored over. But when you got into, say, especially the last third or so, where I was for a while throwing ideas against the wall and seeing what stuck, seeing what felt right, I knew the emotional arc for each one of these characters. I knew their emotional landing spot. But as I was saying before, I didn't want to know how I would get there in advance in most cases. And with her, it was definitely some retooling, not of her character, but of what happens to her and some of the decisions that she made. So that was the biggest challenge by far I've ever had.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from the book?
I kind of do. It's a couple of things that are important to me that are related. One is the idea that forgiveness is vital to the major relationships that we would have in our life. It's a vital ingredient that either needs to be employed or in the cabinet ready as needed. And that it's never just one decision, forgiveness. When you get to a heavy emotional matter where the stakes are kind of high, I think it's a mistake to think forgiveness is like, you either get it or you don't. You either bestow it or you don't. I think it's more like 100 decisions a day sometimes, or just something that needs renewed or revisited or watered like a plant or tended to, you know, so that it has a chance to actually survive. And then connected to that, this idea that while we're defined by our good deeds in life, I think that we're also defined by what we do with our mistakes. And as you were pointing out at the beginning, the novel started with this idea of two people making a mistake. I feel like that is something that is really important, that we look at the people in our lives who are significant to us in one anyway, and see them and value them, not just for the good that they've done, but for how they've cleaned up their own messes or how they're trying to. And that's something that is important to me that I would hope the reader would carry away.
Well, the book is Buckeye. Patrick Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed talking to you.
Buckeye by Patrick Ryan was published by Random House. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.